Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, October 15th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we've got Money and Markets and Ask Catherine, then Building Your Local Food IQ with the wonderful Jean Hamilton, and then we're going to talk together about Let's Go to the Movies, the documentary, The Real Dirt on Farmer John. If you haven't had a chance to watch it before tonight's Soleri Report, I just strongly recommend it. If you love food, it's fabulous. The theme tonight is fresh food, an old favorite. Someone got me to do a quick start for a website several years ago, and they said, okay, you have to kind of bring, we have to bring down how people can get going on really changing their lives in a positive direction, but we have to do it with three quick things, and we came down to turn off your TV, bank local, and eat fresh food. I loved it. And that translated into our motto, who's your banker, who's your farmer, where's your money? There are a couple different ways that a person can sort of get out of, you know, eating, grabbing food on the high run to sort of the slow food revolution. One way is to start to understand what's happening to food in the food world. Next week, we're going to be talking with William Engdahl, who's the author of a couple of great books on what's happening politically around the globe, and one of his finest is called Seeds of Destruction, and it's about genetically modified food. And when you start to learn about the engineering of the food supply, it starts to really revolutionize your thinking about where you get your food and the quality that you make sure is there with your food. I had a neighbor that I've heard about for years but never met came by. He wanted to see if he could buy some of my coolers. And I may have mentioned this last week. He looked at me and he said, as we were talking about it, he said, you know, the food we're buying in the store is killing us. And he had the saddest eyes. But when you start to realize of the dangers and the risks of genetically modified food or very just highly processed food, it really revolutionizes your thinking. The other thing that really revolutionizes your thinking and probably did it for me was I spent a year in Montana with Anna E. Starr, who runs our operations, and Harry Blazer. I come up to work with Harry Blazer, and Harry Blazer started Harry's Farmers Market in Atlanta, which was in the 80s and 90s, but at the peak in the 90s, it was the largest fresh food store in the country, Farmers Market in the country, and then he sold it to Whole Foods and moved to Montana. And when you live in a household and eat in a household where everything is unbelievably fresh and sourced right from the garden or from local farmers, and you see how wonderful the food can be and how great you feel and how delicious it is, when you walk around inside that world, you think, you know, I want to do this. And so you start, I call it my fresh food learning journey because it's really never over. And I hope tonight's discussion is going to help inspire you to, you know, to figure out what are the next steps on your fresh food learning journey that can be really energizing for you, because there are lots of different ways to do it. And the important thing is don't do it because you feel you ought to. Do it because it's fun, because it really does connect you back into all sorts of wonderful things going on around you. Okay, but first, money and markets. Well, there's a lot going on. As we know, the President of the United States won the Nobel Peace Prize, and I was flooded with questions of, oh, my word, you know, what is this about? Obama had only become president, it's only a very short period of time from the time nominations closed. So the question was, how could he possibly accomplished, you know, that level of contributing to peace in such a short time as president? I think it's very important to understand a couple of things. One is that a lot of money on the bailouts went back to Europe. We had sold, and you really need to look at this from the European point of view, we had sold a lot of fraudulent paper, or the Wall Street firms had sold a lot of fraudulent paper to Europe, and it was really as a senator and Democratic candidate, Obama's credibility and sort of political clout, given the extraordinary support coming in from him, you know, much of it negative to the Bushes, that allowed unprecedented bailouts to happen and a lot of money to go back to Europe to take them out of a lot of fraudulent paper, and it has made enormous difference in Europe, and it would not surprise me if that was one of the things that could have done it, because if you look at what would have happened if we hadn't bailed Europe out of a lot of that phony paper, you know, geopolitics would look very different today, and it's hard to imagine that could have been done without Obama's credibility, both when Bush was president, Obama was in the Senate, and then after, you know, what continued as he took the reins. So great deal of money has been shipped to Europe, and it was really Obama, I think, personally, that made that politically possible. There's some other things going on, and what I think the second thing is what I call brand bailout, as opposed to a financial bailout. This is something where you bail out somebody's credibility by giving them a big award. It's the oldest trick in the book. You know, it's not unlike the financial bailouts in that his credibility has been bolstered at the expense of the credibility of the system. But we got a lot of complaints. Oh, this is really weird. But I do want to say it's just going to get weirder. One great subscriber pointed out that the announcement of the Nobel Peace Prize came just as the bombing of the moon happened. If you're interested, go back. I did a blog post on NASA's plan to bomb the moon. But it all goes into the category of it just gets weirder. Then Wall Street has indicated that they expect record bonuses. I mentioned this last week, but it just gets stronger, with the Goldman Sachs bonus pool being reported up to $23 billion, with reports of very profitable high-risk trading on derivatives. So we have a situation where it looks like the bonuses are going to be bigger this year than they were in 2007. Message, again, is crime pays. Now, Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin is tired of paying the implicit taxes to fund these bonuses, and he said from Beijing yesterday or today that he's interested in accepting Chinese currency for Russian oil and gas exports. That's something we're going to talk about a lot next week, because Engdahl's other book, In Addition to Seeds of Destruction, Full Spectrum Dominance, has a wonderful description of the geopolitics of the Russian and oil gas fields. And if you're interested in that topic, I strongly recommend it. The health plan, health legislation, has cleared Senate Finance Committee, and it's expected to meet some opposition when it arrives on the full Senate floor in the week of October 26th. That's not next week, the week after next. So watch for some sparks to fly when that happens. Unemployment, if there's probably one story that is dominant, you know, sort of in the material, in the real world, it's going to be unemployment. Unemployment is unbelievably bad globally. The problems are compounding. For U.S. employment statistics, I strongly recommend John Williams at shadowstats.com. The problem is that now that we've, you know, if you look at the statistics and more people being laid off, then you get a spiral impact as they cut their expenditures, et cetera, that has a dampening impact on business, then you have more unemployment. And as we know, the money has a lot of the bailout, a lot of the stimulus money is going to Wall Street or going to big companies. It's really, if anything, small business is getting hit really hard. And traditionally, small business has been the generator, as we've discussed, of jobs. It's small business and small farms that have created most, not all, the jobs since 1985, along with the military. And so when you slam down hard on small business and small farms, you really slam down hard on unemployment, and that cycle continues. This is one time I really want to encourage everyone. We talked last week about Spike Lee's wonderful documentary, When the Levees Broke, and I talked about, okay, well, that described a natural disaster, but we may be going through the equivalent financially. Now is really the time to think about, if you have financial security, how you can start to set aside some resources to help family and friends who are struggling. There is, you know, the people who did well in New Orleans did well because private citizens were generous with their time and money and made an effort to, you know, to really help to organize, to help people get through. And we're really reaching the point when many of us are going to be called to do more with family and friends. At the top of the blog tonight or tomorrow will be a wonderful interview that Bill Myers did with Marcy Kaptur, the Toledo congresswoman. I've had her up on the blog before. She is an attorney by training and has regularly recommended to her constituents that they should demand in foreclosure procedures that the other side produce the note. And what has been happening in more and more courts, as those foreclosing cannot produce the mortgage note, judges are backing them off and refusing to foreclose. And she is regularly from the house of the from the house floor, advise people to be squatters in their own homes and not let themselves be thrown out. Anyway, so she was interviewed in Michael Moore's new documentary, and Michael Moore asks her bluntly, do you think there's been a financial coup d'etat? And she says, yes. It's quite remarkable. She also says, she points up to the Congress building and says, you know, standing on the steps of Congress, she says, we don't have the power, we lost the power. And so she makes it very, very clear that Wall Street literally is in control and it's private interests that are in control. One story she tells is a description of the chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase meeting with her and a group of other congresspeople, and she trying to explain the problems that they've been having dealing with J.P. Morgan Chase in their community. And she describes what he said, which I would say was basically, you know, he basically threatened her. It was quite amazing, and then promised to send people out to the field to help on the ground. And basically, she and her people got stood up. And it gives you a sense of the extraordinary arrogance. So it's really, it's a must-watch, Bill Moyers with Marcy Kaptur, and also a former economist from the IMF. But you get a sense of the extent of the problem. Next week, I'm going to be doing a series called Anatomy of a Financial Coup d'Etat with Dennis Bernstein on Flashpoints, because we want to talk a little bit about what are the practical steps involved in engineering such a thing. And one, of course, is to burn or destroy the records. I've talked about this before when Dennis and I did Anatomy of a Cover-Up. I'll never forget in 1994 when we were going in, or the early 90s when we were going into my company was doing the HUD loan sales as financial advisor, and we needed to get the documents for the defaulted mortgages at HUD in the region that included Texas and Arkansas, where all the extraordinary mortgage fraud had been during the 1980s. And I remember when we arranged to do, we started to work on that sale, and I said, I can't believe that we're ever going to be able to get those documents and make them public, because there was so much corruption going on. And sure enough, the bombing of the Oklahoma building, city building, happened with all the HUD offices, and all those files were destroyed, and we had to go forward with the sale without a great deal of files. So, you know, but there are hundreds and hundreds of examples of how you burn the trail. But in that spirit, one of the great stories this week was Alan Greenspan says U.S. should consider breaking up large banks. I kid you not. Listen to this. U.S. regulators, this is from Bloomberg, October 15th, U.S. regulators should consider breaking up large financial institutions considered too big to fail, former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan said. These banks have an implicit subsidy, allowing them to borrow at lower cost because lenders believe the government will always step in to guarantee the obligations. That squeezes out competition and creates a danger to the financial system, Greenspan told the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. If they're too big to fail, they're too big, Greenspan said today. In 1911, we broke up Standard Oil. So what happened? The individual parts became more valuable than the whole. Maybe that's what we need. Well, the idea that you would break now that you've given these banks $12 trillion, and now that you would break them up, so it's impossible. I mean, we know we have no idea of where that money went. Break up these banks, and the trail will go cold forever. It's quite extraordinary. Finally, the U.S. stock market went over 10,000. If you look at that inflation-adjusted dollars, it's not much lower than it appeals. To my surprise, silver and gold have continued to hold, and it's a real sign of some real instability in the economy and the markets. But we have more to go. It's dropped down a little bit today. We'll see more. All across the globe, you read stories of problems with the weather and impact on food. I've talked about the kind of problems the farmers here in Tennessee are having because of the incredible rain we've lost. In this area of Tennessee, we've lost most of the crops for the year. It's pretty tough. You read stories of economic stress and all sorts of issues about the contest geopolitically to control resources, and the message is clear. We're in a transition, and the transition is accelerating. Ask Catherine a couple great questions. I'm gonna defer the precious metal questions until our precious metals report early next month. Several questions again on the cliff high scenario. Cliff high of half past human, as some of you may not know, has predicted that we're going to have a real meltdown on October 25th, and he's not alone. There are other people talking about the stresses in the currency and the economy. It's funny, I looked at today at the announcement that the Senate health care reform bill was going to the Senate floor on October 26th, the day after Cliff High's October 25th date. And I thought, well, you know, if Cliff is right, the good news is that we can stop worrying about the health care bill. I do want to say again, I think that, as everyone who listened last week knows, I'm a believer in slow burn. I don't think we're set for a major, a major economic dislocation. At the same time, I just want to say again, I hope Cliff is right and I'm wrong, because we are all much better off in his scenario, believe it or not, than in the slow burn, because we are going through a transition, and the faster that we can sort of leave the old behind and burn our boats and go to the new, the better. I also got a question about Donald Rumsfeld's investments in healthcare and the relationship of those investments to policy. And I have to plead ignorance, because I came from a medical family and I learned long ago that the conflicts of interest are so extensive in healthcare that I tend not to look at the specifics. For example, if you look at the price that we pay for drugs in the United States versus just our neighbors in Canada or Mexico, or I've spent a fair amount of time in New Zealand, the same there, it's just so shocking. You just don't know where to begin. And the more you dig in and look at the conflicts of interest and in the economics of that, it's pretty significant. So, I just have to plead ignorance. It's something I'm not gonna look into. The top question in the voting at the card that everyone wants me to answer is, what is your system for staying alive and telling the truth? So I'm working on answers, and I think I'm going to do as I said last week, I think I'm going to do a special Solari report, because I don't know how to do that quickly. Okay, well, now let's turn to one of my favorite topics, fresh food, and I want to introduce to you our guest tonight. And it's a real pleasure. Her name is Jean Hamilton. She's worked at Organic Farm. She's the head of direct marketing at Northeast Organic Farming Association of Vermont. I had the pleasure several years ago of going to a conference in the first quarter of 2006 at NOFA Vermont, and it was extraordinary. It was I met a lot of farmers. People very interested in food. It was a wonderful conversation. I've never eaten better at a conference dinner. And when I decided that I wanted to do an interview with somebody called Building Your Local Food IQ, it was very important to me to find someone who was really in the trenches helping connect consumers with farmers, because one of the questions I get the most, to my surprise, is, I don't know where to start. You know, I'm busy, I work, I whatever. I really want to just reconnect with the farming and the food people in my place, but I have no idea what to do. How do I begin? What are the steps? So I really wanted somebody who was in the trenches doing it. And if you look at Jean's background and what she's doing, let me just read you just some of the description of her scope of work. She develops direct farmer-to-consumer marketing opportunities through farmers markets and community-supported agriculture CSA programs in Vermont. She coordinates initiatives to make local and organic food more accessible, including promoting stronger farm-to-school connections, linking food stamp benefits to farmers markets, and coordinating a statewide subsidized CSA share program. So this is a woman who knows food, and I couldn't be more delighted than to have her on the Solaria Report. Jean, are you with us?
Yes. Hi. Thank you. It's been really fun to be here.
I would love it if you would just take a minute and tell us a little bit more about NOFA, because I think NOFA Vermont is just a very special group of people. And, of course, you know, you're lucky you live in Vermont, which is, you know, a wonderful – if you want local fresh food, Vermont is just a wonderful place.
That is so true. Yeah, I moved to Vermont to come to college, and right before I came to college, I actually had a chance to work on an organic farm in Washington State, and just absolutely fell in love with farming and realized it was something of a calling for me, and didn't know that coming to Vermont would be such a great place to cultivate that passion for agriculture and food. But Vermont is doing so much right now with local food systems and really building on, you know, many generations and a long, long history of agriculture and agricultural communities. And NOFA Vermont has been a key player in this movement. It's an organization that's about 35 years old. And we are the Vermont chapter of this greater kind of interstate council called NOFA. So all of the northeastern states have a NOFA, but we do operate fairly independently, although we come together regularly to discuss more regional food issues. So within NOFA, we really cover a very broad spectrum of work. Many of your listeners will notice that organic is the second word of our name.
Uh-huh.
And we do act as the organic certifying agency for all of the organic certified Vermont farms and processors. So there are other organizations all around the world and in other states that do that service as well. But we also do a lot of work with education and promotion, and really our other programs do a lot with local sustainable family farms that stretch beyond, you know, purely certified organic farms. So
now you have to help us with definitions.
Sure.
Because one of the things I get early on in this conversation is, what is organic? What does it mean?
Yeah, well, it's a really excellent question. And basically what it means is that it comes from a crop, an agricultural crop that was grown with no synthetic chemicals added at any point in the process. So there are certain, you know, pesticides and herbicides that can be used, although they're all biologically derived.
Right.
So that is the most kind of straightforward definition of organic. And, of course, you know, what is considered certified organic has changed, especially in the last 10 years. Just about 10 years ago, we nationally in the states developed a national organic program so that it's now a USDA certification. And prior to that, it was more regional and independent. So NOFA Vermont had one set of standards, and California Certified Organic Farms had another set of standards. Although they were quite similar, there was no way to say, you know, if I'm certified organic in Montana, I do the same practices as if I'm certified organic in Idaho.
So now, but not everybody, many people can practice organic practices, but they're not certified.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, there's no rule that says you have to be certified to use organic practices. And, in fact, that is a trend we're seeing a lot in Vermont that a lot of people, especially people who direct market, meaning they sell their products directly to consumers rather than through a middle person, you know, like a grocery store, will actually implement and use organic practices, but they won't go through the certification process because it's, you know, paperwork and there's a fee, and
right.
they feel that they have a direct relationship with their consumers so they can really build that confidence that their practices are safe and sustainable. And, you know, when the certification went to the National Organic Program, there were a certain number of people who felt that the standards were watered down or became too bureaucratic or that, you know, they had just sort of lost the feeling that they once had when it was more of an independent process. And we work pretty hard within our organization to, you know, to balance the concerns. And as I said, you know, we have been sort of maintaining and holding the organic torch for 30 years. And so we've lived with organic certification before
right.
the NOP, which is the National Organic Program, and we still live with it now. And so, actually, I think there is a lot of value to the National Organic Program, but we also recognize, you know, why some farms choose not to become certified.
Right. Now, tell me, let's just take 2 seconds because there are two other terms that always come up,
yeah.
and which can still be new to some listeners. One is biodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain biodynamic farming?
Sure, yeah. Biodynamic is it's a different set of growing principles, and it's based in it was developed in Germany, I think, around the turn of the century. And, gosh, I'm having a funny kind of thing that I'm...
It was Steiner.
Thank you.
Yes, it's the anthroposophist.
Right, exactly. So perhaps
right.
you all are familiar with him, but he was a great thinker and developed Waldorf schools and anthroposophy and of course, biodynamics. And so basically, it's very much rooted in organic principles in that no synthetic chemicals are used. But it's also utilizes some other techniques, like planting with the moon calendar, and there are a whole kind of host of basically homeopathic remedies that you use with your crops that are specific to the biodynamic principles. And I personally have not had any experience with growing biodynamically, so I can't.
No, I've read Steiner's Agriculture, which is the Bible,
uh-huh.
or the initial Bible, but yeah.
Right.
Now, permaculture, maybe if you could just say 2 seconds on permaculture so we can make
sure.
Yeah, sure.
Permaculture is basically an idea of it's a highly diversified cropping scheme that really relies more on perennials rather than annual crops, so planting an intermix of trees and shrubs and perennial fruiting, you know, plants with the occasional annual tucked in, and it's really designed to kind of conserve resources and work in a no-till system so that you're not cultivating the soil, but you're actually building soil continually year after year.
Yeah. Okay, so you know, I never knew, when I started, I never knew that fresh food was so complex.
Oh, yes.
So tell us, let's pretend that we're just somebody, we're sitting, we might be in a suburb, we might be in a city,
mm-hmm.
we've been eating on the run, you know, we just assumed we could always get food at the grocery store. Suddenly we wake up, we discover, whoa, maybe I need to think, you know, I may need to rethink this. How do you find local food? How do you build relationships with farmers or farmers? Where do you go? Where do you go? What do you do?
Well, those are great questions. And, you know, I'll just say that as I've had more and more experience eating local fresh food, I find myself more and more when I go to kind of standard grocery stores that I have this experience walking down the aisles of, where's the food here? Where are we hiding the food?
We used to, when we were traveling, I did a lot of road tripping in the late 90s, and we used to play a game of, you know, we'd stop in at one of the Quick Marts, and we'd make a bet as to whether we could find real food or not.
Right, it's amazing. It can be very challenging. Well, you know, there are certainly places around the country and around the world where it's very, very easy to connect into a kind of local food scene, you know, and I think if you live in one of those places, you've probably heard the buzz, and if you open the newspaper, you know, there are restaurant reviews about chefs who are using local ingredients and farmers markets plastered, you know, all over everywhere. So, so if you live in one of those places, I'd really just encourage you to start plugging in and visit the farmers market. You know, if there's a harvest festival that's happening somewhere, go to that and just start talking to people. And, you know, that's a big part of this whole movement is and has been for a long time a part of the organic food movement is really that food is a is an entry point into strong communities. And so
what I've found for a lot of people is that in a place like you describe, there are food co-ops.
Oh yeah.
And the co-ops, it's the farmers markets and the co-ops, which is a very important starting point.
Absolutely. Yeah, and when you go to those places, you know, it's really important that you just not only look and smell and sort of engage your senses in the food process, but also start talking to people and just say, oh, you know, where's your farm? And maybe I could come visit you sometime. And that's what, for so many people, has been really fun about this. It's just a whole, I think you referred to this earlier, but just a journey of really opening up doors and meeting new friends and connecting to a kind of, you know, ancestral tradition that all of us have somewhere in our roots.
One of the things that first got me going in Montana was there's a wonderful group up there called Farmhands, and they made this huge map, you know, fold out like a big Rand McNally map, and it had a it had dots. On one side, it was the map of Flathead Valley, and had dots with numbers. It was like a legend. And you turned the page, and there was a legend on the back, and it listed all the fresh or organic farms in the whole valley and then gave you the information about what they sold and how you could connect with them.
That's great.
And what we finally decided to do, well, Harry and I just got in a car and started driving around and meeting them all.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, getting, you know, going and buying whatever. And it was incredible what we found. And one of the things that the farmhands people told me is that a lot of people wouldn't do that. They, you know, it just wasn't comfortable for them to connect directly with a farmer.
Mm.
And so what they would do is they made up a little list of all the local restaurants that bought local, because what they would do is they would support the restaurants that supported the local.
Interesting. Which is a very, very much so a growing movement. And I think, you know, in most places you can find a chef who's interested in local food. And, you know, and then there are places in the world where this whole local buzz has not really picked up as much, but that doesn't mean there aren't farmers there or gardeners or people who have really held on to their food traditions. And I think there are lots of, you know, different opportunities to find them, either through websites or calling your local, your state agency of agriculture or the local extension agency. You know, basically just remembering that food, local food comes from local farms and agriculture. And so if you just kind of remember, I'm looking for agriculture, you know, that can help you kind of overcome the hurdle of where do I find local food?
Well, it's funny, you know, I'm in a place where there's not a lot of, I'm about the opposite, most opposite of Vermont. You know, Vermont has just got incredible resources, and I'm in barbecue land. You know, so there are like five opportunities to get barbecue within 10 minutes, but no, you know, nothing organic. And one of the links we put up was one you gave me about this edible, I forget what the national network is.
Edible Communities.
Edible Communities. You inspired me to order the Edible Memphis, which came in today, and I'm knocked out because I now have 20 new ideas of where to go. I've been looking for goat cheese, and I have all sorts of ideas now. It's incredible. Maybe you could just describe that network.
Sure. It's really great. We just got a Edible Green Mountains, I guess about 2 years ago here in Vermont. Basically, it's a magazine franchise that, you know, I don't know too much about their history, but a couple of women started. And basically, they have the sort of model and the idea of edible communities, and then local editors and publishers pick up the idea and make an edible whatever for their own region. So we have edible Green Mountains, you have edible Memphis, there's edible Cape Cod, you know, edible wherever, Bay Area. And the local editor will just put together articles and resources on how to find local food and farms in that region. And it's really remarkable. I think there are, you know, over 50, maybe not quite that many.
There are a lot. On their website, there are a lot.
Yeah, there are many, many, many. And it's really amazing how specific they get to a region. I mean, for us, we have, you know, one magazine for the whole state. But, of course, I just opened their website, and I'm seeing Edible Low Country. I don't even know where that is, but some Low Country has their own edible magazine.
Uh-huh.
You know, Edible Philly, Edible Piedmont, Edible Pioneer Valley. So they're just, and they're beautiful magazines, and they really do. We were talking before the call about, you know, not only are the articles great, but the ads in there are great. You know, lots of local farms will put in listings, and maybe little farm stands that sell a variety of local and organic products are listed there.
Now, if I want to find the farmer's market in my place, how do I do that?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think one of the best places is this website called Local Harvest,
mm-hmm.
which has done a pretty good job of pulling together farms, community-supported agriculture programs, and farmers markets for the whole country. So that's, you know, I've looked at it a couple times for Vermont, and they don't have every single person on there, but they have a pretty good start at least. And there is a new website, actually, that I was just reminded of today, and it's pretty similar. It's called Local Dirt. And
Local
just,
Dirt?
That's right, Local Dirt. And they're trying to do a similar thing. So, and
uh-huh.
they're a little bit younger, but I know that they are really working hard to pull together, you know, a list of all the farmers markets. There's also a National Farmers Market Coalition that I think would be a great place to, I don't think they do a directory, but you could certainly call them and say, I live, you know, in this area, and I can't find a farmer's market. Can you help? And the great thing about people in this movement is that they're so passionate and excited.
They love to teach. Everybody loves to teach. It's incredible.
It's true. Everybody wants to talk about food and farms. So, you know, any of these people you call are going to be excited to talk to you and point you in.
See, I come from the financial world where nobody wants to tell you anything, and they're all lying to you. So going into the food world is very shocking.
Yeah, it is funny.
It is funny. Well, here's another one, because this was a big hump for me to get over. I'm part of a dinner group that we meet locally, and we talk about different things to help each other sort of build, you know, immediate resilience in our group. And we had one dinner where they finally persuaded me to start planning, you know, start planting orchards, start planting, you know, shift to edible landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And, I, you know, it was a big hunt for me because what do I know? I kept reading different magazines. And so if you're sitting in a house with a traditional sort of landscape and you realize, look, why don't I just redo this so that everything is edible?
Yeah.
Where do you go? How do you learn?
Oh, that's such a great question.
I mean, if you want to learn all this stuff and not make mistakes but do it in a way that's fun, how do you start to learn?
Well, I think what was so amazing to me about that first farm I worked on, you know, having grown up in the suburbs my whole life, is how natural it felt and how pretty logical it was, you know.
Right.
You clear a little area, you put a seed in, you water it, and it will grow. That's the miracle that I continue to remark at. But, of course, sometimes it doesn't grow, and that can be really disappointing and intimidating.
I don't know. In Tennessee, it always grows.
Well, that's great. So I think, you know, really the biggest hump is just getting up the confidence and the courage to give it a try. And
right.
nine times out of ten, it's going to grow. But basically, you know, I would encourage people to look for a local nursery. That's always a great
place. Do local nurseries ever do teaching workshops? Or?
Yes. Definitely. I mean, I wouldn't say all local nurseries, but it is pretty common. And if
right.
not a, you know, organized workshop, these people grow things for a living. So they are
right.
there, and they're going to be happy to talk to you about growing. But also, you know, there's some great seed companies that have a lot of information on their websites, and of course, you know, National Gardening Association. And
right.
I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the Extension Service, but that's it's something that everybody used to know about. But basically, it's out of, you know, all of the land grant universities. They have these extension agents who are agricultural experts, and they, you know, are sort of always ready to pick up the phone and answer your questions about what's wrong with your tomatoes or what's the best seed.
Right, and they'll help you with the soil testing if you need that.
Exactly, that's a great
right.
point. And you know, for people who are living in suburbs or maybe even in urban areas, I'd really encourage people to even just put out, you know, a little pot of basil next summer, because it just will grow and it will make you feel so excited. And it's good to sort of start smaller than bigger, I'd say.
Right.
Because it can become overwhelming. But if you do have a suburban lot, you know, an apple tree looks so beautiful in a yard, and it's great to just, you know, start with something. And I am so sure that once people start eating anything from their backyard, they're going to want to put in a lot more.
Right. There's a wonderful video that I put up on the blog about a couple months ago about a family in California that lives on a remarkably small plot and does most of their food from their plot. Hmm. It's quite extraordinary. I don't know if you've seen it. And it kind of goes around the permaculture networks. But it shows you what you can do over time
yeah.
if you just continually, you know, build towards edible landscapes. And there's nothing like picking it and eating it 5 minutes later. I mean, we've had a garden here. I've had various neighbors helping me with a garden, and it's just extraordinary. You know, it's just extraordinary to see it grow.
Mm.
And the only challenge is keeping the deer out of it.
Right. It is extraordinary. It's so affirming and is such a positive influence to bring in your life. But I'd also say, you know, just listening to the beginning of your call, it's such a really important way to feel secure.
Right.
Being able to know where your food comes from and that is not coming from a truck from far, far away, you know, it really brings a very tangible sense of security to your daily life.
Right. I think security, just security and safety around food is a very important thing, because the more you know, the more, you know, when there are just tremendous numbers of restaurants where I will never stop. And because you just don't know what's in it, and it's scary. Maybe if we could talk just a second about seed banks. Could you explain what seed banks are and the opportunity in seed banking and why seeds are so important?
Yeah. Wow. Well, of course, I wish I had the numbers just off the top of my mind, but we have lost a just astounding number of plant varieties and plant species, really, from our agricultural language internationally. And,
right.
You know, that is really thanks to the industrialization of agriculture and what we've done to breed seeds for particular traits. And now that we do have genetic engineering, our seeds are so much more in danger. But basically, seed banks are a place where you put away varieties of seeds, and lots of the, you know, kind of important international ones actually freeze the seeds, and so they conceivably should be good for hundreds and hundreds of years. But it's basically just a place to preserve genetic diversity.
And is there a way to, how do I learn if I want to know how to learn who the seed banks are in my area, or to support them, or the people doing seed banking, or the good seed companies? How do I do that?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah. I wouldn't say that there's like a look for this or that with seed banks or seed companies. You know, some of it is you just sort of have to
network.
Start learning a little bit more about varieties. And if you open, you know, for instance, if you get five different seed companies to send you catalogs and you go and you look at their green bean varieties, you'll see that they're basically all carrying the same five varieties.
Right.
And
how do I find the seed companies and know that I'm getting really high-quality organic seeds.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're looking for organic seeds, you'll want to look for, you know, a certification, an organic
right.
certification. That will ensure you that those are organic seeds. You know, otherwise, I could kind of recommend a couple that I think are great. Johnny's Seed Company is out of Maine, and they do a lot with small farmers all around the country. They tend to have really high-quality seeds. We have a really excellent seed, organic seed company here in Vermont called High Mowing Seeds.
High Mowing?
Yeah. And they
okay.
have really, you know, are one of the kind of primary suppliers for organic growers around the country. There are also some kind of neat companies like Seed Savers Exchange that really focuses on preserving heirloom varieties. Heirloom in opposition to hybrid. Heirloom varieties are ones that are, they're also called open pollinated. It basically means you can plant the seed and harvest the seed from that plant and plant it the next year, and it would grow the same genetic type that its parent was. With hybrid seeds, they've been basically really intentionally hybridized, and so if you plant that seed, it will not grow a true type to what its
right.
parent was. So, and the heirloom varieties are really fun. They, you know, they tend to be, have been selected and bred for things like flavor and high nutritive value, rather than more of the modern hybrids, which tend to have been bred for pest resistance or, you know, longevity of fruit keeping or storability. So, it's, you know, a lot of your listeners will probably have heard of heirloom tomatoes, which are kind of how heirloom has become most famous, but there are heirloom everything, and they always tend to be a little bit more special tasting.
One of the, I'll never forget the first time I heard the word CSA, I was in California, and I was having, I was at somebody's home, and I was eating the food. It was just fabulous, and I commented, you know, your vegetables are so fresh. And she said, well, I'm a member of a CSA. And she said, in fact, I used to get sick all the time. And then we joined the CSA, and I never get sick anymore. And I said, what's a CSA? So maybe if you could tell us what a CSA is.
Sure, yeah. CSA is sort of an intimidating sounding word, but it stands for Community Supported Agriculture. And it's basically a marketing scheme that came out, history says that it simultaneously came from Switzerland and Japan to our country. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. But basically it's an idea in which consumers, you know, invest in a farm in the spring before the farm has started producing, providing the farmer some income when they have no product to sell, and then reap the rewards of their investment throughout the growing season through, you know, weekly shares of whatever's been grown.
So you're basically buying, you're prepaying for your food for the season up front.
Exactly.
So, and the farmer can use that to finance their planting and harvesting.
Right. It's an extremely valuable tool for the farmer because, of course, in the springtime when they're just getting started, they have the majority of their expenses. They have to buy seed and, you know, cultivate their land, and it's basically all input, and they have nothing they can sell at that point. So it's really important that they have that income early in the season. And, you know, different CSA programs have had different amounts of member involvement. So some, I know that the, you know, Japanese CSAs tend to be more like the consumer, a group of consumers sort of hires a farmer with that springtime investment, and then they, you know, dictate to a certain extent how the food will be grown, you know, whether it'll be organic or this or that. And then other farms involve members more in that they really ask members to help on the farm or, you know, assist with other marketing or kind of CSA membership. So it, and then some CSAs, you just order your subscription and then pick up your box each week.
Right. When I was up in Montana, there's a wonderful, wonderful organic, she calls it a garden. To me, it's a farm. It's huge. But it's Purple Frog Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we go work a couple hours a week and get food.
Yeah.
You know, you'd get paid in food, and it was fabulous. Cause
yeah. And, you know, the CSA model now has spun out and has many, many different sort of iterations. And some, I know that there's some farms in Vermont that basically you just order a kind of debit-style card, and then you can use that at the farm stand and pick out whatever produce you like.
Really?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah,
I've never seen that.
It's kind of interesting. And, you know, it's sort of embedded in that kind of classic understanding of CSA is that you will reap whatever is most bountiful on the farm that year. So that if there's just a incredible bounty of tomatoes, which we did not have here this year, you know, you'll just have, you know, as many tomatoes as you want, but maybe that same year the broccoli didn't do as well, and so you might not get as much broccoli.
The one of the things very much in my heart, I used to be on the board of the food bank in New York, and one of the things very much in my heart is food banks, because they do so much to supplement a lot of diets or to move food around a community. And there's a lot more hunger than people think, and especially in a time like this. And I don't know if you have any food banks in Vermont, but one of the things I'd love to see happen is more fresh food going into the food banks.
Yes, and how long ago did you work with that, TJ?
Oh, that was, I'm going to date myself now. I was on the board in the late 80s.
Well,
and
I think you would be really pleased to see what's happening in the whole emergency food world.
Really?
There's really a much, there is a movement towards including more fresh food in particular. But there are also places who are really being innovative. The Vermont Food Bank just actually bought a farm with hopes that they will start growing food for their own food bank.
Oh, fabulous!
In the face of obesity and diabetes and diet...
That is absolutely fantastic.
Yes, everybody realizes, you know, that fresh food is really... You know, we have to move away from this idea that hungry people just need calories. And at this point, so many hungry Americans are really, you know, starving through obesity and that feeding them kind of empty processed calories.
Right, they're starved for nutrition.
Right, exactly, is just not really helping. So there's a lot more inclusion of fresh fruits and vegetables in food banks and food shelves.
Yeah, another thing which is very, very important is as a, you know, I'm as a financial person, when you look at the food systems in a place, what you start to realize when you look at the economics of it is the amount of money that is being spent on food or purchased by institutions, including government institutions, is very significant. And whichever way that money goes has a dramatic impact. You know, if that money goes all corporate, then you don't have that money building up the local fresh systems. And, of course, there's no more important institution than the schools.
Right.
Particularly because you're talking about the health of the kids. And I know you work on connecting farmers with schools.
Yes, yeah, it's a great program. And, again, it's one of those things that I feel so lucky to be here in Vermont. We have the program I work with is called Vermont Feed, which stands for Food Education Every Day. And we work with about 100 schools statewide. And, you know, it's just... It's the perfect kind of blend of ingredients here. We've got great farmers, and we have great schools with really excellent food service professionals and really nice communities and people who are ready to make this happen. But as you say, it's just so, so important that kids are able to eat good meals.
Are they doing any teaching of gardening and farming in the schools yet?
Yes, there are many schools now that have school gardens that different classes use in different ways, and we have one school, a high school, that has just started an innovative farm apprenticeship program, which is, you know, it must
that
be
is fabulous.
To some people who grew up on farms or, you know, who are from a generation older than I am, but for us it's kind of novel and really feels positive and like a step in the right direction to be getting people back in touch with how food is grown.
I just saw a fascinating presentation about a month ago by one of the technology centers here on the future of jobs, and they were talking about the growth of farming in the organic area, you know, organic or sort of clean food area. And, you know, it was interesting to see a government official here in Tennessee predicting the growth of farming.
Wow.
I know.
That's amazing.
I was like, okay.
Yeah.
When I wanted to mention when I was up in for your conference, I sat at dinner next to a farmer. She and her husband started a farm for, as you describe, in Japan. They had a group of families, and they just produced. They had a cost-plus relationship, whatever it cost them to do everything they did. You know, the families paid them that amount of money plus a markup, and they were really in the business of producing a very big percentage of those families' foods.
Wow.
And I saw that when I just got back from Switzerland, when I was in Switzerland in the spring, same thing. I told you the story of a group of families that got together, bought some land, and then brought farmers from Eastern Europe to Switzerland and just said, look, you're in charge of putting together and organizing and growing or finding all of our food, but we want to know where our food comes from. So I think you're seeing more and more of this very proactive, you know, investment in the relationships and the resources you need to find ways of making your own food locally.
Yeah, well, those are great examples, and I think it's, you know, it's also very remarkable that so many people are interested in being farmers and that we have a real sort of kind of wonderful problem here in Vermont, which is that we have all these young farmers who want to farm, but they have a hard time getting access to land. But it's just, it continues to amaze me how many people of my generation, you know, you ask them what they want to be when they grow up and they say,
they want to be farmers. Go ahead.
I just think, you know, for me, it really reflects that our society has gone so far to the other side. You know, if we just want to be purely leisure and, you know, have no physical aspect to our lives that's demanded of us, and that we've seen that actually that is not very pleasurable.
Well, I think one of the opportunities, if members of my generation can find young people who want to become farmers but need help buying land.
Right.
You know, and rather than have your money invested in, you know, far, far away things that are increasingly risky, why not invest in farmland and helping, you know, a couple young farmers get going in a way that, you know, provides you with food. And I think one of the reasons we should mention let's just switch to The Real Dirt on Farmer John.
Mm-hmm.
I love that documentary. The Real Dirt on Farmer John is a documentary about John Peterson, who grew up on a traditional family farm. And the documentary follows his incredible journey from big ag subsidy farming and then getting busted in sort of the pump and dump of the farmers in the 80s and then transitioning to organic farming and finally to building a very successful CSA in, I guess it's Angelic Organics. And in the process, his CSA members, they're so successful they run out of land. And so some of the members in the CSA get together and invest in land contiguous to his property so that he can expand. And it's a great example of the building the pathways to re-engineer, because to really build local food systems, we need to switch not only our purchases, but we need to switch our investments.
Mm.
You know, and so there's the, you know, there's a lot of different things that have to come together. And I think when you see the movie, when you see the documentary Real Dirt on Farmer John, you really see how those pathways, one example of how those pathways get built over time. And it's those are the pathways that all of us are there to explore wherever we are.
Mm.
Okay, well, one of the other things I thought we might like to just discuss, I don't know, were you ever a woofer?
I was, actually.
Okay, well, maybe you could, because I know... maybe not subscribers, but kids and grandkids.
Uh-huh.
woofer is something that we might want to consider for other members of our family.
Sure. I absolutely recommend it. I woofed in Italy.
Oh, really?
For a total of 8 months, but during two different trips. Basically, woofing is this funny acronym that stands for Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And I'm pretty sure it started in Australia or New Zealand. But basically, it's this, very simple network of farms. They're usually localized within a country. So it's basically just a list of farms that are looking for help from people and then are willing to provide, room and board and possibly some pay in exchange for work on their farm. And, essentially it's like a exchange, just a cultural exchange that's based in agriculture. And there are every kind of opportunity you could imagine from
all over the world. I mean, if you're
in a villa to years, on a farm in India. So really it is. It's all over the world.
It's a great way to see the world.
It is such a great way to see the world. If you find yourself that you're ever one of those travelers who's like stuck in a hotel in some tourist town and you think, oh, I wanted to come to this country to see what it's like, and now I just feel like I'm stuck in a kind of empty world and I can't touch the people, you should try woofing.
You're just flocking. How old can woofers be any age?
Yes. There is a farm for anybody out there. I'm convinced. Just in Italy alone, there are about 275
farms. Oh, my.
That participate, and they really do run the gamut of anything you could expect.
Well, so, we put the woofing link up in the blog post, so if anybody's interested in exploring, there's a very interesting website that will introduce that to you. Well, our time has come to an end. So maybe, Jean, in closing, if you could just describe how we could keep up with you and your work and NOFA, and particularly for the subscribers who are in the New England area, how they could maybe plug in.
Sure, yeah. Well, certainly people could visit our website, which is just nofavt.org. We have lots and lots of information there about farming and marketing and finding food. But if you live in another northeastern state, you have your own NOFA, and you could Google that and find it. All of the NOFAs have conferences. We have a really wonderful winter conference in February.
That's the one I went to. It's really great.
It's so great. We have hundreds of workshops, everything
uh-huh.
from growing blueberries to making soap. So that's a lot of fun. And then there's a big regional NOFA conference in the summertime that's in Massachusetts. But there are also really great conferences in other places, a conference called EcoFarm in California, and, of course, all over the country all the time there are wonderful
right.
opportunities to learn about this. So, I as we said earlier in the call, everybody in this movement is so excited to talk to people and to teach them what they know and to open up doors. So, really, whatever your entry point is,
Right, and nobody makes you feel stupid that you have no idea. I mean, because when I first showed up, I just didn't understand any of the words, and no one makes you feel bad at all. So you just jump in and you start wherever.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and we really appreciate it. Have a wonderful evening, Jean.
Great, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Okay, well, that's it for Building Your Local Food IQ. Jean's absolutely right, just jump in. And we hope you do. I wanted to mention again, we're doing the Soleri Report Digest. If you want to get the podcast, just link from our homepage. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all the support for GATA between now and the end of the month. We are donating $75 from every annual subscription we get to help GATA's efforts to ensure the Federal Reserve their feet are held to the fire over transparency about their relationships with private entities and intervention in the gold market. Coming up next week, an incredible, incredible interview on geopolitics, the global chessboard, what's next with William Engdahl, the author of the Seeds of Destruction and Full Spectrum Dominance, which I strongly, strongly recommend for those interested in geopolitics. Our movie is one of my all-time favorites, 3 days of the Condor. If you haven't seen it, it's Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway. It's a classic. It's very entertaining, fun to watch. I strongly recommend. So until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, especially a local food conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.